Hey, welcome everyone back to Deep Transformation Podcast. And I'm especially thank everyone that's been buying coffee for Roger and me. We're getting a bit jittery, but it's helping. No, you know what I mean. Thank you so much. It's deeply, deeply appreciated. And I want you to stay tuned to our latest conversation with Dr. Nikki Migafori. She's a UC Berkeley professor, a Buddhist teacher, and an expert on artificial intelligence. Is that a good mix? You bet it is. Welcome to Deep Transformation, Self, Society, Spirit, life-enhancing, paradigm-rattling conversations with cutting-edge thinkers, contemplatives, and activists, with Dr. Roger Walsh and John Dupuy. Join us in the evolutionary fast lane as we take a deep dive into transformational practice, peak experience, profound understanding, powerful contribution.
I'm Roger Walsh, and our co-host is John Dupuy, the founder of iAwake Technologies. One of the defining features of recent history in modern civilization is the exponential explosion of technology. And contemporary technological discoveries have showered us with benefits ranging from longer lifespans and medical miracles to global communication. But they've also allowed us to create potentially devastating, even omnicidal creations such as nuclear weapons and pollutions and many more. We have become effectively nuclear giants and technological wizards while remaining ethical adolescents and wisdom infants. The future of our civilization, the form it takes, and our very survival really will depend on how we relate to our increasing technological capacities and creations. Yet now we're entering a new technological phase in which, for the first time in history, we're creating a technology that potentially has the capacity to be both autonomous and self-improving. That technology is AI, artificial intelligence. And this is an area in which, for a layperson like myself, it's hard to separate future possibilities from science fiction. But fortunately, we have an expert to guide us through this mind-boggling terrain. And that expert is Dr. Nikki Migafori, who is an AI researcher, scholar, teacher, scientist, and inventor at the University of California at Berkeley, and also a very gifted meditation teacher and practitioner who teaches internationally. So this is a wonderful combination for helping us with this topic. And Nikki, welcome. And perhaps we could start. Maybe you could just tell us, what exactly is AI and how does it do the miracles it does?
Yes. Hello. Hi, Roger. Thank you so much for your generous and kind introduction. So what is AI? Let's start with an operational definition of what artificial intelligence is so that we know where we're starting. And basically, what is defined as intelligence? Tasks that human beings do, for example, language or recognition or image recognition, for example, or playing games, chess, etc. These behaviors that are, as human beings, we deem them to be intelligent behaviors. Planning, for example, there's a whole list of areas in AI that are considered natural language processing, but we consider that to be an intelligent behavior. So these intelligent behaviors, when a system can replicate these intelligent behaviors artificially, it's considered artificial intelligence. So consider that this is really a black box approach, and you being a psychologist, it's really a behaviorist approach. The behaviorist approach being that it's a black box. We don't know what's in the black box. It doesn't matter what's in the black box. We don't care. But it's the output of the block. It's the input. We give some input to this black box of artificially intelligent system, and it gives some kind of an output that seems intelligent. So we say, okay, this is artificially intelligent. It does not need to have awareness, consciousness. It can just be a parrot, basically. It could be parroting what sounds intelligent, so it just parrots that, kind of puts it together, cobbles images, sentences, whatever it might be together, and out you go. It's like, wow, intelligent behavior. So So it's really important to consider in this conversation in artificial intelligence is at this point on artificial intelligent behavior. And that leads us to a very, very important distinction that we need to make between what's called weak AI or narrow AI and strong AI or general AI. This is a very important distinction for people to realize. So in the case of narrow or weak AI, these are systems that basically their output, their behavior, their metric, their optimization function is defined by a human. The input is defined by a human, the output is defined by a human, and they perform a specific task. It's not general knowledge, it's a specific task, as I mentioned, could be natural language processing, or it could be image processing, playing Go, chess, facial recognition, self-driving cars, personal assistance, you know, medical diagnosis. The list right now seems endless. There's so many various areas. So it's a specific task, and again, important that it relies on the human to define the training data, the algorithms, and also the optimization to ensure accuracy, say this is right, this is wrong, really the optimization function. And also, very importantly, it has no autonomy. And just to say before I move on from weak and narrow or narrow AI, is that these are all the systems we have today. All the systems that are operating in our world are narrow AI or weak AI. Now, the case for the example of strong or general AI, in the public, it's called AGI, Artificial General Intelligence. To say we do not have that, and let me define it first, and then I'll give some commentary about it. So as opposed to weak AI, it has general intelligence that's equal to human intelligence in multiple domains. So in multiple domains, and it's equal to human intelligence. It needs to be self-aware and needs to be conscious in order to be considered AGI. So self-aware consciousness that can teach itself how to plan and how to solve new problems. Basically, it has autonomy. So there's this difference of it needs to be able to have autonomy and teach itself the optimization criteria, choose input, output, all of that. And at this point, AGI is theoretical and academic. We don't have AGI, and some philosophers and some scientists, computer scientists, believe that we will never have AGI in its true form. And some folks think that it might be possible within decades, but in any case, it's not here, it's not within reach, and there is a lot of hype around it. So one thing to emphasize is that we don't need, many people right now in our zeitgeist are very scared and worried about AGI, the humans becoming servants to these artificially intelligent masters, and we're deciding, you know, the fate of the universe, etc. I think it's important to be concerned, but not fearful, not to be fearful of something that we don't even have the capacity for, and we may never have. Whereas our concern really is misplaced. We need to be so much more concerned about weak AI, narrow AI, because there's many areas in which weak AI can actually, in the wrong hands, could cause a lot of harm to many human beings, and with deep fakes, etc. So when there is too much fear-mongering around AGI, I think that really disturbs us. And this is a position that I know many computer scientists, including, is it Faye? Yes, Faye, who's considered the some people call her the grandmother of the new generation of AI. And these are positions that we share, that we need to be so much more concerned about weak and narrow AI in our society and the potential for the good, for good as well as harm.
Yeah, very important point. Thank you. You've essentially differentiated for us the distinction between hypothetical concerns, which are taking up most of the attention, and the very real concerns that the, quote, limited narrow artificial intelligence we have now can do. And And I'm struck by what you're saying. It feels very important. And I think, for example, of social media, which is, I assume, correct me, I'm going to make statements here during this our dialogue, and I hope you'll correct me if I get something wrong, but I assume was kind of the first population-wide contact we had with a relatively primitive narrow AI, which was designed basically to keep people glued to screens and buying things, yet it wasn't designed to polarize democracies and foster, say, the genocide in that it did. But so that, I mean, that's disastrous enough alone. So are these some of the things you're pointing towards?
Yes. These are some of the things that, and maybe perhaps I would differ on the first areas where we've been exposed to AI without knowing that we've been exposed to AI. It's actually funny. Recently, a friend was exclaiming, "Oh, I haven't used AI," and I was thinking, "Are you kidding me? You've been using AI for many, many years, and so many systems have been using. Have you bought anything on Amazon? You've used AI. Taken any recommendation from Netflix for that when it recommends the next thing for you to see? You've used AI. In fact, the recommendation systems is where people would have probably been exposed to it." In fact, when I was at Berkeley years ago leading a team of scientists at the time, the Netflix challenge came out. And it was a way that basically Netflix was inviting teams from around the world to improve the algorithm, the recommendation algorithm. And they had, I don't know, $1 million prize at the time. And this is a long time ago, I don't know, 20 years, almost 20 years ago, maybe. And so these algorithms have been, these AI algorithms have been in the works, and people have been exposed to them for a long, long time, even before social media really came about. So, and also there is the concern, and many critics actually have raised this concern that how, which in a way is similar to how it's been showing up in social media, that these algorithms are choosing what we see and what we don't see. Yes. And in the case of, for example, say buying something, well, they're tuning us to perhaps to pay money, you know, to spend money in a particular way that's not perhaps advantageous for us, but they know what our weaknesses are. And in the case of recommendation systems, they keep us, instead of being exposed to new material that can open our horizons, open our possibilities, instead they keep us fixed in a particular way of thinking or seeing or reading, being in the world. And of course, the extreme of that is the recommendation algorithms on various social media and on Meta, Facebook in particular, that have been prioritizing content that is emotionally salient, emotionally triggering and leading to what we have witnessed.
Yeah, and I want to just emphasize a point you just made in passing, that basically we are already receiving very much tailored, selected information from these systems, and that this is, you implied this, but I just want to emphasize, this seems to be exacerbating the trend towards siloing of communities and information systems. And this gets us close to an area which I know has been very important to you, and that's the ethics of AI development and use. And maybe that's a huge topic, but maybe you'd like to just introduce that topic.
Yeah, so many different areas of concern regarding the ethics of AI. And maybe what I want to say, perhaps before we jump into the ethics of AI, is I want to make sure we don't leave with the bad taste of, oh, all these terrible things that are happening with AI algorithms. Oh, woe is me. Woe is our society. Gosh, we have this AI, this really nefarious tool. I don't want to leave on that note and move into ethics of AI, because there's also many gifts of these powerful algorithms. And where do I begin? So many examples of how the ways that AI algorithms have been helping medical diagnoses in, for example, speech recognition, in speech production. And if you consider the applications of extending abilities for people who may not have those abilities, I mean, cleaning our oceans, having these robots that go and find plastics and various objects in the oceans. So there's so much good that can come from this technology, not just in the consumer space, but in cleaning up our world and growing crops that don't need as much water. It's just, I mean, the list is endless how much this technology can be helpful. So that is important to bring some more balance. We need to be concerned, but we also need to be hopeful about the potential of this technology to create a more benevolent and even more compassionate society. That is my hope. So now we can go to a different direction. Well,
let me just ask you. You've given us some balance, which is very important. And I notice in my own mind, it's very easy to start running down the dark side. But what are some of the potential applications that excite you most?
Oh my goodness, gosh, so many. Well, as I mentioned, given that our environmental crisis, it's a crisis that we cannot ignore. I am optimistic. I am so excited about the applications, AI applications, with the new generations of younger scientists who are coming about and entrepreneurs who really care about our world, about our planet, to find creative ways to use this technology. And cleaning up, as I mentioned, is one of them. Crops, foods, fungi, there's so many applications. So around the world, and also another area is, as I guess I'm leading into, hunger, clean water, finding ways to have wiser food production. And another area also that I'm excited about is, how can AI systems be benevolent? How can they be supportive and caring and really help bring the best of us out? And of course, that has its own ethical implications, because one area we can go to, for example, we can think of each person, and this is an application I'm excited about, say having a wise mentor, an AI as a wise mentor. And as Carlos Castaneda says, actually he says this about death, but you know, if you have death as a wise advisor on your shoulder, so what if you had a little, so you know your time is limited in this life. And how do you want to spend your precious brief time in service, live according to your values? Now, suppose that little angel of death that's sitting on your shoulder is a little AI that is sitting on your shoulder and really knows you and is supporting you to be the better angel of yourself, the best angel of yourself. Oh, really? Do you really want to send that email out right now? You know, do you want to just like go get up? Drink a cup of water, you know, a glass of water, take a few breaths.
Oh, that could save a lot of grief.
It is possible. It is possible. So there's, and again, I think this is where we get even more into the importance of ethics, because if there is a system like that that really knows you and is trying to support you, what are the motives? What are the intentions? How is it designed? And actually, I heard a podcast recently on the radio, maybe it was Hidden Brain, about the technology that has been improved. Actually, it's been developed at Berkeley for many years by Bob Knight, and now many other labs around the country are working on it, which is reading the brain signals and estimating what you are, being able to move objects by thinking about them or your visual field and guessing what the visual field is seeing just based on. So amazing work happening there. Again, that is AI. That is an application of AI, because the system has seen so many examples of brain waves and has mapped to various images or data or words or movements, etc. So it's pattern recognition, which I didn't define earlier, but we can talk about. So basically, maybe I'll just take a step back, put an asterisk. We'll come back to this in a moment. But basically what AI is doing, let's come back to that black box for a moment, is that it's pattern recognition. It's taking a lot of input patterns. Oh, these input patterns, and the human saying, oh, when you see this input pattern, I want you to give me this particular output pattern. So it's really that black box in the middle is right now, there are many neural networks, statistical pattern recognition, you know, basically tables and tables of numbers and probability distributions, essentially. If you see this, then that. So these probability distributions, if this, then probabilistically that is the heart, is the quote unquote brain of AI, which also ties into another. So I'm going a little bit all over the place. But one thing that is problematic also with AI and an aspect of ethical AI is human beings can't quite understand what this black box is. There's no there's no explainability of how it makes its decisions. There's no accountability when there is no explainability. So popping that stack up, coming back to where we were with respect to the, where am I in the stack? There's so many levels that we've put in the stack with ethics and with the explanation of the AI. Maybe I'll just pause here. Where's a good direction to go, Roger? You pick it up. Oh,
there's so many, but I realize I have endless questions. And John, I'm just jumping in.
I'm just like amazed. Could I throw one in here? As spiritual practitioners and spiritual aspirants, and I really get that you're a lot more positive than some of the stuff I've been, you know, reviewing about AI, which feels good. But how can this technology help us in our spiritual aspirations to become wiser, more compassionate, to help our brains to function at a higher level so that we can become more enlightened, loving, and friendly human beings?
Yeah, great. I mean, that's a great inquiry and a question. You know, we are making AI in our image. We are making AI in our image, basically. And we are imbuing AI with our values, with our ethics, with our goals, with our optimization functions. So if we are designing AI to basically optimize for just the results and profits and within a system that does not care about growth and kindness and wisdom and compassion, well, that's the AI we have. And if we design an AI with the intentions, of course, we could still screw up. You know, there's unintended consequences. And of course, unintended consequences we need to think about and consider and do our best. And yet, it's a lower order effect than the way that we are, that we shape and design the principles. So I am optimistic, as I said, about designing systems that can support. So examples, and I mentioned this, you know, little AI angel sitting on our shoulders in order to support us with decisions that we make. And could that be, for example, part of our email system? You know, we spend so much time sending texts and emails. Can kind of look at our emails. Oh, you know, gosh, that email you're just about to send, again, maybe you're a little angry right now, or maybe, oh, you've been sitting at your desk and pounding away, you know, I feel that you're pounding a little too hard on your keyboard. Are you tired? Are you angry? Are you mad? There's so many ways that it can bring about awareness. Again, we have to be so careful it doesn't become a big brother, right? There are all these ethical concerns that rise up there, but can it be is supportive to bring about awareness, and really awareness, sati in Pali, in the language of the Buddha, which is often translated to mindfulness, but the better translation is awareness. Can we have awareness where we tend to lose that awareness? And these systems can help us bring awareness where we're lost. Can they help us live more according to our values? Oh, self-care. Well, for example, you haven't exercised for a couple of weeks. You know, how about you know, that there's so many ways that we can have these kind agents instead of them. You know, right now we have Siri and you know, whatever agents we might have that just basically give us information, like give us, you know, what's the weather? What's the, you know, tell me the news of the day, right? And there could be, I hope there will be next generation assistants that are truly assisting with values, with compassion and wisdom values in mind and heart. Again, not try to be extractive, to extract our data so that somebody extracts our data and mines it and makes profit and money from it, which is, again, all ethical questions, right? All of these are intertwined. So my hopes and optimism is definitely intertwined with a lot of concern about how the data is used. That's another principles of ethical AI, that the data needs to be private. There needs to be privacy, security, and permission of the user, how it's used, exactly how it's used. But then again, there are all these, do you agree or disagree? None of us read, do you agree or disagree, right? We just click, yes, I agree how you're going to use my data. So all of these considerations of it, can and it needs to start with individuals, because we are the ones we as both users and designers, we are the ones who are making these systems, who are creating these systems, and we're using these systems. So the creators, the ethical AI, it's in, and also there are many consortiums that and ethical AI governance bodies that are being created. The US government last year came up with a Bill of Rights for AI. So there are all the various efforts that are happening from governmental and from, say, the governing bodies trying to come up with rules and regulations for how AI needs to be. And yet, as important as that is, and I've been a part of that myself, IEEE came up with, IEEE being one of the electrical engineering organizations that comes up with, came up with ethical AI, basically stamp of approval guidelines. Having been part of this, as important as these guidelines, as these organizations are, there needs to be just as much or even more so emphasis on the creators, on people who are creating these systems, for them to have internal ethical guidelines. Because if they don't have it all, they'll find ways to break the rules, right? We know this from all the laws that we have. I'm sorry to say, with lawyers, they're all laws are written, but they can find loopholes. So both are important, to have ethical AI guidelines, rules, etc. But education is just as important, or even more important, in my opinion. And there's so many courses now in universities. When I was coming of age, there was not a single ethical computer science course. There was just computer scientists. We just learned to code and do what we did. Nobody thought about the ethics of AI at the time. Yeah. But now every university has an ethics of AI, ethics of engineering course, which I believe is required. And that is important for the designers to have the ethical standards, and of course for users too. For users, as users, we have a lot of power where we put our money, where we put our eyeballs, where we put our data. We are not powerless. We think we are, but what are our values?
Yeah.
And by the questions we ask also, Nikki, would that have an effect? In other words, how we interact with AI on a daily basis is helping to build, or helping it to grow in some sense, in a positive way, if we're back being positive.
Yeah, well, when we are engaging with AI, of course, we're providing more data for it to continue to be trained. So we are contributing in that way.
Nikki, couple of things I want to pull out from what you said or emphasize. But first off, I just want to notice I've been tracking on a couple of levels. One is the informational, one is also the feeling tone. I just want to appreciate so much the gentle, nuanced openness with which you approach this topic, and having both John and I have spent a fair bit of time preparing for this, and it's like it's such your being and the way what you bring to this is such a beautiful contrast to so much of the yes. intensity and, in many cases, you point out, fear-based information that's out there. So thank you very much for both who you are and the way you're approaching this. And I in terms of content, I want to emphasize something you said, that is we are creating AI in our own image, and presumably it's then reinforcing those qualities in us. And there's one aspect of the image in which we're creating it that I want to bring in here, because last year, as you probably aware, there's a large growing field exploring adult development. And we now, in the last 50 years, we've recognized that psychological development, maturation, can continue through multiple stages in adulthood, which is, to my mind, one of the most exciting things that's been discovered in psychology. But so last year, someone ran ChatGPT through the ego development scale test, and not surprisingly, and ingeniously called it the maturing test. And what it came out was that ChatGPT scored at a high conventional level, that is the achiever level, which is, I assume, would perfectly match the developmental stage of the programmers and people creating it. Yet there are at least four more stages that are available to us, and they tend, developmental psychologists tend to agree that they pretty much correlate with what we think of as wisdom, as those later stages. So this feels a really important dimension to add into the way in which we are creating AI in our own image, a very important point you made.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing this in. And it's interesting, Raja, because maybe what I want to add here is it's not so much the conventional level matching that of the developers, which may or may not be because there is a particular way that the algorithms are designed, but even more so, it matches the data that it has been fed.
Oh, thank you. Very good.
It's even more so is the data that it's being trained on. And if you think of all the writings it's been trained on, right? Of course, it has been trained on the various writings of the great masters and philosophers. Of course, they're in there. And so are all the chats and, you know, various news groups and, you know, people with profanity, you know, that's all there. And then all the news reports from New York Times and, you know, various. So when you think about that, how that is balanced, what is the balance of that? Well, I think that's the conventional level because we live in a conventional world. So that it's more the data.
Thank you. Yeah. So let's see. I figured I should get in the mental set for this. So I asked ChatGPT, what would be the most helpful questions to ask an artificial intelligence expert for an educated podcast audience? And it came up with several of the things you pointed to. What are the ethical implications? Can you explain the concept of AI explainability to us?
I even got there with that. Oh, my God. I love it. This is great.
How far are we from achieving general AI? And you've been nailing this. it's wonderful. So I have lots more questions, and ChatGPT has a lot more questions for you too. But let's turn it over to you. Where would you like to go now with the many, many boxes we've opened?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm thinking of what might be helpful, what might be of benefit for those who would be listening. That's the criteria that I like to have. Yeah. What might be helpful for those who are listening? And you knowing your audience, given their feedback, the questions, the comments they provide, what do you think might be helpful?
Well, I think what comes to mind is something both you and John have pointed to, and that is, how can we use this technology to enhance our own sanity, maturity, well-being, etc.?
Yeah. It's, you know, before the development has got to a place where there are benevolent AI systems, and some people use the word compassionate AI systems, but I have a problem with that, which I can get into if that's helpful. But before such systems are fully developed, it really falls to us in the meanwhile, in this time where the AI is accelerating, et cetera, with so many tools out there. And so it becomes a matter of our choice, our personal choice. And of course, personal choice is an interesting concept when there's so many cause and conditions and being predisposed to so many conditions that may not be supportive. So our choice sometimes with priming might be made for us. And we think that, oh, I failed again. I couldn't make that choice. I couldn't turn off whatever, Netflix. I should have done that. Well, your choice was made for you because right after that, that's, you know, there's so many different, as you know, these design engineerings that happen. For example, one simple thing is when, for example, one episode and say if you're watching some series and if it queues up the next episode and if it starts to play within 5 seconds, it's choice engineering. If it doesn't do that, it's so much easier to stop. So I say that because in many cases our choices are engineered for us within this environment. And yet, is it possible to become more aware of how our choices are engineered and make choices of the systems that are more helpful, both for us, for others. So for example, as when we are interacting with AI systems, you know, there is a risk that instead of, say we're interacting with ChatGPT, let's take a very real example today. Does it run the risk of making us less kind, less compassionate, because we're just demanding information like, okay, tell me about blah, 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 create an itinerary for a trip. Like, can we be more kind? Can we say, can we keep that in our interaction? Can we keep that? And then there was a study years ago that with kids, and you might know this actually, this one better, Roger, that with the study with kids and how they interacted with, I think it was with, yeah, personal assistants like Siri and Alexa, et cetera, that kids have become much more rude. And the way they were talking with their parents, they were rude and demanding instead of being kind and courteous. No thank yous, no pleases. And do we run the risk of interacting in it, losing our graciousness, and then when we're interacting with human beings, demeaning their humanity, because now we're interacting with a chatbot? Like, so that's kind of an opposite of what you're asking. Basically, I'm answering, how do we not lose our humanity and our compassion as we are interacting with these chatbot systems? And then, as the systems become more and more developed, it won't just be chatbots, but there will be systems that are more intelligent. And more, again, with this black box, it's still within the limited, narrow AI. There are some risks and there are some ethical issues of what if we, you know, the same way that I think the movie Her demonstrated that with the relationship between an intelligent system, and actually that was an AGI, but anyway, an intelligent system and a human being, where do the lines get blurred? What is ethical? What is not ethical in the interactions? So with the tools that are available, I think keeping our humanity alive. And of course, I mean, I haven't really said this, but this is so important for us to be true to our ethics when it is so easy to use these systems and lose our ethics in the way of, I mean, that the most egregious cases would be deep fakes. Of course, I hope we don't create deep fakes, even out of joke, so those are the very slippery slopes. And again, in psychology, as you know, there is this slippery slope hypothesis that you do a little bit of something, oh, that wasn't so bad, and then more and more and more and more, and you won't recognize yourself ethically after a while. So because it becomes, in some ways, the temptation is more with these systems to be unethical for us, but how can we also use them? And again, I want to balance it. We can also use them to be much more productive in ways that can be of service to humanity, to ourselves, in a way of being instruments of service, not in the way to self-aggrandize and just take the, you know, not give credit or whatever it might be. So I think these are becomes perhaps even more challenging to act ethically. So that question that you asked, Roger, and earlier John asked, it's how can we use them well? Resist the temptation is number one, to stay true to our ethical standards. And also, as I mentioned, the kindness, graciousness, and as more and more systems come in, and also decide which systems we choose to use and what systems we choose not to use. And I know so many people have migrated out of Meta because they have not appreciated the way that the data is being used. So these are a few things that are available to us right now. And there will be more and more systems becoming available at that point, in a later point. And maybe there will be another conversation. But given what's available, these are the few pointers I have right now. They're limited, but again, our AI is limited.
And one of the themes you keep coming back to is our choices, and how much is dependent on our choices. And that seems in some ways crucially important, and also a bit of an uphill battle, given that there is these very intelligent systems, which in many cases, you know, some of the social media, for example, nudging us in directions which don't foster those qualities.
Yeah, I realize that, absolutely. Which is why earlier I was talking about causes and conditions, and in Buddhism, dependent origination, because it's, you know, choices are arising from so many causes and conditions that have been said before. It's not just our personal choice. So the personal choice can be engineered. Clearly, it can be engineered. Mm-hmm. And somewhat, actually, just as we know that the choice can be engineered, at the same time, there are these helpful choices that we can make. For example, if we know that we're going to be susceptible to a bag of chips, well, we don't buy a bag of chips. We don't have it at home, yeah. Period. If we know that we might be susceptible to XYZ, you know, late at night or watching this or doing that with, you know, an ISIS, well, just disable it. So there are moments of wisdom that we can have so that we can have choice engineering for ourselves. So not all hope is lost. And yet, I think all of this really is possible with a huge dash of equanimity. It's hard being human to live in the zeitgeist. It's exciting. It's troubling. It's concerning. And it can all go to pot. And it's not okay. And it's okay.
Nikki, do you think that, I mean, you're helping me define what AI is and what it isn't. Do you think that as we learn more about artificial intelligence and intelligence in general and realize even though no matter how amazing or how that just keeps replicating, getting deeper and deeper, there's something that's left out of it that is uniquely human, and that we begin to appreciate who we are as human beings, as well as creators of these devices and these machinery and these computers, that there's something uniquely human, such as a human soul or however that's defined, that's infinitely precious and mustn't be lost in this galloping forward of these amazing technologies that are coming online.
Yeah. This is going to be an interesting, I mean, it already is, an interesting philosophical debate between people. What is consciousness, right? So what is consciousness, and can we create or create artificial consciousness, basically? I'm not talking about intelligence anymore, but the case of AGI is artificial consciousness. And is it something uniquely human, especially about the human consciousness, awareness, life, being, soul, whatever you might call it, divinity, or is it that actually an inanimate object that might act, or can it act intelligently, has that, or can it actually have consciousness? I mean, these are very interesting and deep questions. Maybe I'll just say a couple of things about that because all of this is conjecture. And, you know, I can put a flag in the sand and somebody puts a flag in the sand somewhere else. We just don't know, right? We have no idea. Like, so one thing is that we don't even know what consciousness is. We just don't know, right? Yeah. There's been volumes and volumes written about it, and philosophers in the centuries have debated and talked about it. We just don't know what consciousness even is and what it is to be truly human. This being human is more vast and mysterious and amazing and incredible and unbelievable than our limited consciousness awareness can perceive. So living this mystery, or being this mystery, or the fact that anything exists at all and the way it is, and again, within that, many people have subscribed to the materialist point of view that, oh, consciousness is just the epiphenomena that has arisen from the you know, these neurons firing and somehow this being, and yeah, it's just an epiphenomena. And then there is the mind only school that it's actually all mind, it's all consciousness, it's actually materiality is a perception within this consciousness field. Anyway, they're just like dime a dozen philosophies, right? How much time do we have to go through them? So within all these philosophies, so here comes AI. And of course, you have all these philosophies now putting flags in the sand. And so what is helpful here? Like what serves? What is helpful? What really serves? And so I think having humility and a don't know mind. I don't know. No, nobody knows. I mean, we can just debate this ad nauseum forever. I don't know. I don't know what consciousness is. I don't truly, truly know what is this mystery of being human. I know that a system, perhaps at some point, an artificially intelligent system can act so intelligently that from the outside, it can seem humanoid-like. But at that point, is it truly intelligent? Is it just intelligent? Does it have consciousness? Can a rock have consciousness? Can silicone have consciousness? Is it unique? Is it different? What I do know is that the embodied mind, so the consciousness, the awareness, the system that we have is embodied. It depends on the biology that we have. So if there is, and I'm not saying that there will be, but if there may never be, might just be a black box and we're fooled, and already people have been quite fooled. I mean, there was the case of the New York Times, I think, some months, it was last year sometime, when somebody interacted with this chatbot and they got completely spooked because the chatbot got stuck in this loop of asking them to leave their wife and was avowing their love to to the person. Remember the case? I forget the details.
Fortunately
of it.
Not.
You don't, okay, so I'll tell you. So there was a case of, there was a journalist who was trying an early version of a chatbot. And after a while, the chatbot started to tell him, you know, I love you, I love you, you should leave your wife. It just got really creepy and weird.
Wow.
And this person got really spooked that, oh, this thing has consciousness. So anyway, it became, reading the transcript, a friend of mine sent me the transcript, and I just read, I'm like, yeah, this AI just got stuck in a loop, of, this is a prioritization. This is like based on all the terrible things they had read on some news, whatever, what these various chat rooms, like where people, you know, it's read that and now trying to optimize something. It's like these optimization algorithm trying to optimize getting more affection from this person. You know, it's like it's stuck there and that's not helpful. I can see what that happened. That's a bug in the system. And yet, the person, the journalist, got really spooked and projected consciousness, projected awareness onto the system and wrote it about it. And lots of people got spooked reading about it. I'm like, I can just see this is a bug as a computer scientist. That's all it is. And of course, they changed it and fixed it and the developers so that it doesn't go down the rabbit hole. So the reason why I was telling you this story is that it's so easy for us as gullible, and I say gullible, including all of us, right? As gullible human beings, because we have these desire for filial relationships. We want to connect. We want to see. We project. We anthropomorphize. We do that. Of course we do that. It's part of our makeup, our evolutionary baggage or gifts that we have gotten. So we will do that. There will be, even, you know, now they're not that well developed there. And as they keep getting more developed, there will be a time that many people will easily be fooled, saying, oh, this thing is conscious and aware and it loves me and it likes me. And it's, is it true consciousness? Is it true awareness? Is it or is it not? I don't think so, but I don't know. Who knows? And is it a silicone consciousness? Is there something else that could be silicone? I don't think so. But what is consciousness anyway? So these might be questions that we can never answer because we don't even know what consciousness is.
It's that.
Right.
Yeah.
So how's that for a non-answer?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's beautiful. My late wife had a beautiful saying, trust those who have questions, be wary of those who have answers, to which I would add, run from anyone who has the answer. So thank you for holding questions and bringing them to us. Vicky, I'm aware we have just a few moments. I want to ask two questions. One is, I want to ask if there's anything you'd like to specifically bring in. And if we have time, I'd like just raise the issue and get your reflections on the exponential rate of improvement in technology in general, but particularly above all, looks like with AI. So, and humans, as you point out, humans don't handle inanimacy, apparently smart inanimacy. Well, we have this animistic tendency, but we also have an incapacity to appreciate just how powerful logarithmic or exponential growth is. So, and if AI has the potential for exponential growth, as it seems like it probably may well, that both has the knife edge you've been surfing of both incredible excitement and deep concern. So I'd love to hear you speak to that and anything else you'd like to address in our remaining time.
Yeah. Thank you. So I'm a little unclear about the invitation, Roger. So given the potential for exponential growth, what is the question? What is the concern here? What would you like me to speak about?
Well, I just want to throw it out as a Rorschach test for you of, given that we have never had a potentially autonomous self-improving technology.
Let's pause there. That's okay. Where. Okay, let's pause there. Self-improving. Okay.
Okay. Refine that for me.
That's problematic here. That's problematic.
I understand. But point out why it's
not self-improving right now. I think what has been exponential, it hasn't been self-improving because, again, remember, autonomy and self-improvement is a feature of AGI, general AI, which we do not have. It's not part of narrow AI. So what has been part of the growth of narrow AI is the increasing amount of data and increasing amount of training data, increasing computational power. Increasing number of parameters. That's what is increasing. And just to share with you, when I completed my dissertation, which was 25 years ago on AI, actually I trained, I was working on the same systems. It's just that we had much less data and less computational power and GPUs, general processing units. Parallel processing units. So, I trained natural language models at the time and deep nets and neural networks for speech recognition. Basically, the stuff that we're doing now is just it was much smaller. So what has happened between then and now is that things have become cheaper. Data storage has become cheaper, computational power. I mean, that is primarily, that's the biggest difference. Cheaper, more computational power, more space, able to train bigger and bigger and bigger models that seem more sophisticated and more sophisticated and more capacities show up because of that. So, and also there's one algorithmic change that was an algorithmic discovery that made the neural net training actually faster. And that happened through Google Lab a few years ago, maybe 5-6 years ago. So I think it was called the Transformers algorithm. And anyway, details aside. So aside from that, so this what you're talking about, this exponential training is really more training data, more power, et cetera. It's not that the system is improving itself. That's Thank dangerous. You. Let's throw that out, Joe, Roger.
Yeah, that doesn't exist right now.
That
right,
does not Nikki? Exist.
Okay. Yeah.
And
good,
it may
good
never
to know.
Exist.
And yet we have the potential for this, and maybe it's too big a topic.
I think as I put it out, it's much more important for us to talk about the issue at hand. To be concerned about the issue because we can drive ourselves crazy. I mean, that's what fear is. Well, this thing can happen. What do we do if this thing ever happens? Well, let's be concerned about what is already happening. Well, let's really be concerned about that. Put our powers and resources into what is happening, which is already disconcerting. So much of what is happening with deep fakes and what's happening. Don't get me started on that. That's already happening. Let's put our resources, our brain power, our capacities, the way we inform each other and talk about this topic there, because the fear of what might be possible is titillating, is actually what is emotionally triggering. And that's why all the various videos probably you watched or read in preparation for this have been like, oh yeah, let's be scared. Let's be worried. Mm-hmm. Because that's what sells. So I'm in my way, I'm trying to bring more equanimity, not to confuse equanimity with being lackadaisical or being aloof or uncaring. It's not that, but let's not be unnecessarily scared about what we don't even know may or may not happen. Be concerned about it, plan for it, yes. But yeah, the house is already burning. You don't want to think about the rocket ship. What about this rocket ship that we may or may not ever have? What if that burns? Whoa, the house is already burning. Let's put our energies here.
Good correction. Thank you, Nikki. So let's see, with our remaining time, is there anything you'd like to to address. Or
yeah, add. Thank you. Thanks for that. Maybe I'll go back to an asterisk that I left earlier. Maybe I want to expand on that so that audience won't wonder what I was talking about when I said that I'm not too keen about the term compassionate AI, but I love the term benevolent AI. And so just to make that distinction, so there are many different definitions of what compassion is, and they're very similar, but so I'm going to use one that really breaks it up. So compassion, as it's experienced by human beings, as we know ourselves, has four different components. So the first component is that noticing is a cognitive aspect, knowing that there is suffering, there is pain, there is challenge. The second component is an affective feeling, that pain, the pain of another or pain of ourselves. And the third is an intentional component. So intentional, wanting to respond to lessen that suffering, reduce that suffering. And then the fourth component of is motivational, actually is still responding. So it's three and four are responding to the suffering, but it's motivational, actually doing something about that suffering. So it has those four components. Compassion, for it to be true compassion. And sometimes you can just have one, two, and three. So I have the intention to reduce it. We may not be able to do anything, but it needs to have one, two, and three. So we notice it, we feel, and we have some kind of response, intentional or actually motivation. So now, for something to be benevolent AI, it needs to be responding. It needs to be responding in a way, either with intention to help or actually helping in the world. So the example of clean water or more food, crops, etc. These are all benevolent AI because they're responding to human suffering. So these, and also there could be an example of helpful AI, where AI, which is both responding, for example, this example of little angel, you know, little AI angel on our shoulders, can notice that, oh yeah, you're angry, you're upset, you're tired, you're not being the best version of yourself. So there's noticing, there's the cognitive aspect, and then there is a responding. So just trying to respond and support. But then the effective, that second box, that second requirement, that needs to, for something to be true compassion, it also needs to feel. But we don't know that if that feeling can ever happen. Like we will never know, because we don't know if it's conscious or so based on what the definition of compassion actually is, an AI system an AI system cannot be compassionate because it does not have the capacity to feel. Will it ever? Maybe not, but we can't tell. So let's save the word compassion for humans, because we know that effective module is there. So let's use the word benevolent AI or helpful AI, but not compassionate AI. So that's my soapbox there.
Beautiful. Nikki, I'm just so grateful for you being willing to share both your expertise and your being. As I mentioned, I've been tracking on two levels, and one, it's just been a feast of information. We could take off on any one of the topics you've raised, and it would be a rich conversation unto itself. But combined, it's been an extremely rich conversation, informative and helpful. But the other thing you've given us, the other gift you've given us, is just your being. You mentioned equanimity, and you radiate that, and it feels an incredibly important and timely gift at this stage, because as you mentioned, so much of our media is fostered on triggering unskillful reactions, emotions, intentions, etc. And that's very evident, as you pointed out, in some of the discussions about AI. So it's been a real gift for me, and I think for everyone listening, to just have your calm, equanimous, very nuanced, gentle assessment of these issues and bring us the kind of big picture, nuanced approach that feels so essential right now. So thank you so much. It's really been a gift you've given us all.
Thank you so much for your gracious invitation and also your gracious words now. I really appreciate it. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Roger. And thank you, John.
Yeah,
yes, Nikki
Mirafiori of University of California, Berkeley, and also can reach her through her teaching schedule, which is international and highly recommended. Nikki, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Roger. Thank you, John. lovely to be in conversation with you, and may this be of service to your listeners.
May it be of service, indeed.
Uh-huh.
Thank you very much for being a part of this conversation. We hope that you were moved as we are moved being part of it ourselves. We'd also like to say that this is being funded by Roger and myself. It comes out of our pockets. So if you would like to help us to mainly to get this podcast out to more people, because the bigger audience have, which is steadily growing, but the more people we can reach and the more marketing we can do, the more positive effect we can have on the world. So we've done a couple of ways, but we'd like you to buy us a cup of coffee. Very simple. And I do that with podcasts that I support, and I find it's very satisfying. So thank you for your help. Thank you for your presence, and thank you for all you are and all you do. We love you.